on his grandfather's claim to take the life of Salman Rushdie. Who am I to adjudicate in such a dispute? However, the idea that the identical text can yield different commandments to different people is quite familiar to me for other reasons. There's no need to overstate the difficulty of understanding Islam's alleged profundities. If one comprehends the fallacies of any revealed religion, one comprehends them all. I have only once in 25 years of often heated arguments in Washington, D.C., been threatened with actual violence. This was when I was at dinner with some staffers and supporters of the Clinton White House. One of those present, a then well-known Democratic pollster and fundraiser, questioned me about my own most recent trip to the Middle East. He wanted my opinion as to why the Muslims were so all-fired goddamn fundamentalist. I ran through my repertoire of explanations, adding that it was often forgotten that Islam was a relatively young faith and still in the heat of its self-confidence. Not for Muslims, the crisis of self-doubt that had overtaken Western Christianity. I added that, for example, while there was little or no evidence for the life of Jesus, the figure of the Prophet Muhammad was by contrast a person in ascertainable history. The man changed colour faster than anyone I've ever seen. After shrieking that Jesus Christ had meant more to more people than I could ever imagine, and that I was disgusting beyond words for speaking so casually, he drew back his foot and aimed a kick which only his decency, conceivably his Christianity, prevented him from landing on my shin. He then ordered his wife to join him in leaving. I now feel that I owe him an apology, or at least half of one. Although we do know that a person named Muhammad almost certainly existed within a fairly small bracket of time and space, we have the same problem as we do in all the precedent cases. The accounts that relate his deeds and words were assembled many years later and are hopelessly corrupted into incoherence by self-interest, rumour, and illiteracy. The tale is familiar enough, even if it is new to you. Some Meccans of the 7th century followed an Abrahamic tradition and even believed that their temple, the Kaaba, had been built by Abraham. The temple itself, most of its original furnishings having been destroyed by later fundamentalists, notably the Wahhabis, is said to have become depraved by idolatry. Muhammad, the son of Abdullah, became one of those Hunafa, who turned away to seek solace elsewhere. The book of Isaiah also enjoins true believers to come out from the ungodly and be separate. Retiring to a desert cave on Mount Hira for the month of heat, or Ramadan, he was asleep or in a trance, I'm quoting Pictol's commentary, when he heard a voice commanding him to read. He replied twice that he was unable to read, and was thrice commanded to do so. Eventually asking what he should read, he was further commanded in the name of a Lord who created man from a clot of blood. After the angel Gabriel, who so identified himself, had told Muhammad that he was to be Allah's messenger and had departed, Muhammad confided in his wife, Khadija. On their return to Mecca, she took him to meet her cousin, an elderly man named Waraka ibn Nufal, who knew the scriptures of the Jews and Christians. This whiskered veteran declared that the divine envoy who once visited Moses had come again to Mount Hira. From then on, Muhammad adopted the modest title of Slave of Allah, the latter word being simply the Arabic for God. The only people who at first took the smallest interest in Muhammad's claim were the greedy guardians of the temple at Mecca, who saw it as a threat to their pilgrimage business, and the studious Jews of Yathrib, a town 200 miles distant, who had been for some time proclaiming the advent of the Messiah. The first group became more threatening, and the second more friendly, as a result of which Muhammad made the journey, or Hijra, to Yathrib, which is now known as Medina. The date of the flight counts as the inauguration of the Muslim era. But as with the arrival of the Nazarene in Jewish Palestine, which began with so many cheerful heavenly auguries, this was all to end very badly, with the realization on the part of the Arabian Jews that they were faced with yet another disappointment, if not indeed another impostor. According to Karen Armstrong, one of the most sympathetic, not to say apologetic, analysts of Islam, the Arabs of the time had a wounded feeling that they had been left out of history. God had appeared to Christians and Jews, but he had sent the Arabs no prophet and no scripture in their own language. Thus, though she does not put it this way, the time for someone to have a local revelation was long overdue, and once having had it, Muhammad was not inclined to let it be criticized as second-hand by adherents of older faiths. The record of his 7th century career, like the books of the Old Testament, swiftly becomes an account of vicious quarrels between a few hundred or sometimes a few thousand unlearned villagers and townspeople, in which the finger of God was supposed to settle and determine the outcome of parochial disputes. As with the primeval bloodlettings of the Sinai and Canaan, which are likewise unattested by any independent evidence, millions of people have been held hostage ever since by the supposedly providential character of these ugly squabbles. There is some question as to whether Islam is a separate religion at all. It initially fulfilled a need among Arabs for a distinctive or special creed, and is forever identified with their language and their impressive later conquests, which, while not as striking as those of the young Alexander of Macedonia, certainly conveyed an idea of being backed by a divine will until they petered out at the fringes of the Balkans and the Mediterranean. But Islam, when examined, is not much more than a rather obvious and ill-arranged set of plagiarisms, helping itself from earlier books and traditions as occasion appeared to require. Thus, far from being born in the clear light of history, as Ernest Renan so generously phrased it, Islam in its origins is just as shady and approximate as those from which it took its borrowings. It makes immense claims for itself, invokes prostrate submission or surrender as a maxim to its adherents, and demands deference and respect from non-believers into the bargain. There is nothing, absolutely nothing, in its teachings that can even begin to justify such arrogance and presumption. The Prophet died in the year 632 of our own approximate calendar. The first account of his life was set down a full 120 years later by Ibn Ishaq, whose original was lost and can only be consulted through its reworked form, authored by Ibn Hisham, who died in 834. Adding to this hearsay and obscurity, there is no agreed-upon account of how the Prophet's followers assembled the Quran, or of how his various sayings, some of them written down by secretaries, became codified. And this familiar problem is further complicated, even more than in the Christian case, by the matter of succession. Unlike Jesus, who apparently undertook to return to earth very soon, and who, pace the absurd Dan Brown, left no known descendants, Muhammad was a general and a politician, and though, unlike Alexander of Macedonia, a prolific father, left no instruction as to who was to take up his mantle. Quarrels over the leadership began almost as soon as he died, and so Islam had its first major schism between the Sunni and the Shia before it had even established itself as a system. We need take no side in the schism, except to point out that one at least of the schools of interpretation must be quite mistaken. And the initial identification of Islam with an earthly caliphate made up of disputatious contenders for the said mantle marked it from the very beginning as man-made. It is said by some Muslim authorities that during the first caliphate of Abu Bakr, immediately after Muhammad's death, concern arose that his orally transmitted words might be forgotten. So many Muslim soldiers had been killed in battle that the number who had the Quran safely lodged in their memories had become alarmingly small. It was therefore decided to assemble every living witness together with pieces of paper, stones, palm leaves, shoulder blades, ribs and bits of leather on which sayings had been scribbled, and give them to Zayd ibn Thabit, one of the Prophet's former secretaries, for an authoritative collation. Once this had been done, the believers had something like an authorized version. If true, this would date the Quran to a time fairly close to Muhammad's own life, but we swiftly discover that there is no certainty or agreement about the truth of the story. Some say that it was Ali, the fourth and not the first caliph, and the founder of Shi'ism, who had the idea. Many others, the Sunni majority, assert that it was Caliph Uthman, who reigned from 644 to 656, who made the finalized decision. Told by one of his generals that soldiers from different provinces were fighting over discrepant accounts of the Quran, Uthman ordered Zayd ibn Thabit to bring together the various texts, unify them, and have them transcribed into one. When this task was complete, Uthman ordered standard copies to be sent to Kufa, Basra, Damascus, and elsewhere, with a master copy retained in Medina. Uthman thus played the canonical role that had been taken in the standardization and purging and censorship of the Christian Bible by Irenaeus and by Bishop Athanasius of Alexandria. The role was called, and some texts were declared sacred and inerrant, while others became apocryphal. Outdoing Athanasius, Uthman ordered that all earlier and rival editions be destroyed. Even supposing this version of events to be correct, which would mean that no chance existed for scholars ever to determine or even dispute what really happened in Muhammad's time, Uthman's attempt to abolish disagreement was a vain one. The written Arabic language has two features that make it difficult for an outsider to learn. It uses dots to distinguish consonants like B and T, and in its original form it had no sign or symbol for short vowels, which could be rendered by various dashes or comma-type marks. Vastly different readings, even of Uthman's version, were enabled by these variations. Arabic script itself was not standardized until the later part of the 9th century, and in the meantime, the undotted and oddly voweled Quran was generating wildly different explanations of itself, as it still does. This might not matter in the case of the Iliad, but remember that we are supposed to be talking about the unalterable and final word of God. There is obviously a connection between the sheer feebleness of this claim and the absolutely fanatical certainty with which it is advanced. To take one instance that can hardly be called negligible, the Arabic words written on the outside of the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem are different from any version that appears in the Quran. The situation is even more shaky and deplorable when we come to the Hadith, or that vast orally generated secondary literature which supposedly conveys the sayings and actions of Muhammad, the tale of the Quran's compilation, and the sayings of the companions of the Prophet. Each Hadith, in order to be considered authentic, must be supported in turn by an isnad, or chain, of supposedly reliable witnesses. Many Muslims allow their attitude to everyday life to be determined by these anecdotes. Regarding dogs as unclean, for example, on the sole ground that Muhammad is said to have done so. My own favourite tale goes the other way. The Prophet is said to have cut off the long sleeve of his garment rather than disturb a cat that was slumbering on it. Cats in Muslim lands have been generally spared the awful treatment visited on them by Christians, who've often regarded them as satanic familiars of witches. As one might expect, the 6 authorized collections of hadith, which pile hearsay upon hearsay through the unwinding of the long spool of isnads, A told B, who had it from C, who learned it from D, were put together centuries after the events they purport to describe. One of the most famous of the 6 compilers, Bukhari, died 238 years after the death of Muhammad. Bukhari is deemed unusually reliable and honest by Muslims, and seems to have deserved his reputation, in that of the 300,000 attestations he accumulated in a lifetime devoted to the project, he ruled that 200,000 of them were entirely valueless and unsupported. Further exclusion of dubious traditions and questionable isnads reduced his grand total to 10,000 hadith. You are free to believe, if you so choose, that out of this formless mass of illiterate and half-remembered witnessing, the pious Bukhari, more than 2 centuries later, managed to select only the pure and undefiled ones that would bear examination. Some of these candidates for authenticity might have been easier to sift out than others. The Hungarian scholar Ignaz Goldzier, to quote a recent study by Reza Arslan, was among the first to show that many of the hadith were no more than verses from the Torah and the Gospels, bits of rabbinic sayings, ancient Persian maxims, passages of Greek philosophy, Indian proverbs, and even an almost word-for-word reproduction of the Lord's Prayer. Great chunks of more or less straight biblical quotation can be found in the hadith, including the parable of the workers hired at the last moment and the injunction, "Let not thy left hand know what thy right hand doeth," the last example meaning that this piece of pointless pseudo-profundity has a place in 2 sets of revealed scripture. Aslan notes that by the time of the 9th century, when Muslim legal scholars were attempting to formulate and codify Islamic law through the process known as ijtihad, they were obliged to separate many hadith into the following categories: lies told for material gain and lies told for ideological advantage. Quite rightly, Islam effectively disowns the idea that it is a new faith, let alone a cancellation of the earlier ones, and it uses the prophecies of the Old Testament and the Gospels of the New like a perpetual crutch or fund to be leaned on or drawn upon. In return for this derivative modesty, all it asks is to be accepted as the absolute and final revelation. As might be expected, it contains many internal contradictions. It is often cited as saying that there is no compulsion in religion, and as making reassuring noises about those of other faiths being peoples of the book, or followers of an earlier revelation. The idea of being tolerated by a Muslim is as repulsive to me as the other condescensions, whereby Catholic and Protestant Christians agreed to tolerate one another or extend toleration to Jews. The Christian world was so awful in this respect and for so long that many Jews preferred to live under Ottoman rule and submit to special taxes and other such distinctions. However, the actual Quranic reference to Islam's benign tolerance is qualified because some of these same peoples and followers may be such of them as are bent on evil-doing, and it takes only a short acquaintance with the Quran and the Hadith to discover other imperatives, such as the following: nobody who dies and finds good from Allah in the hereafter would wish to come back to this world, even if he were given the whole world and whatever is in it, except the martyr who, on seeing the superiority of martyrdom, would like to come back to the world and be killed again. Or, God will not forgive those who serve other gods beside him, but he will forgive whom he will for other sins. He that serves other gods besides God is guilty of a heinous sin. I chose the first of these two violent excerpts from a whole thesaurus of unsavory possible ones, because it so perfectly negates what Socrates is reported to have said in Plato's Apology, to which I am coming. And I chose the second because it is such a patent and abject borrowing from the Ten Commandments. The likelihood that any of this humanly derived rhetoric is inerrant, let alone final, is conclusively disproved, not just by its innumerable contradictions and incoherences, but by the famous episode of the Quran's alleged satanic verses, out of which Salman Rushdie was later to make a literary project. On this much-discussed occasion, Muhammad was seeking to conciliate some leading Meccan polytheists, and in due course experienced a revelation that allowed them, after all, to continue worshipping some of the older local deities. It struck him later that this could not be right, and that he must have inadvertently been channeled by the devil, who for some reason had briefly chosen to relax his habit of combating monotheists on their own ground. Muhammad believed devoutly not just in the devil himself, but in minor desert devils or jinns as well. It was noticed even by some of his wives that the prophet was capable of having a revelation that happened to suit his short-term needs, and he was sometimes teased about it. We are further told, on no authority that need be believed, that when he experienced revelation in public, he would sometimes be gripped by pain and experience loud ringing in his ears. Beads of sweat would burst out on him even on the chilliest of days. Some heartless Christian critics have suggested that he was an epileptic, though they fail to notice the same symptoms in the seizure experienced by Paul on the road to Damascus. But there is no need for us to speculate in this way. It is enough to rephrase David Hume's unavoidable question. Which is more likely? That a man should be used as a transmitter by God to deliver some already existing revelations, or that he should utter some already existing revelations and believe himself to be, or claim to be, ordered by God to do so? As for the pains and the noises in the head or the sweat, one can only regret the seeming fact that direct communication with God is not an experience of calm, beauty, and lucidity. The physical existence of Muhammad, however poorly attested by the Hadith, is a source of both strength and weakness for Islam. It appears to put it squarely in the world and provides us with plausible physical descriptions of the man himself, but it also makes the whole story earthy, material, and gross. We may flinch a little at this mammal's betrothal to a 9-year-old girl, and at the keen interest he took in the pleasures of the dining table and the division of the spoils after his many battles and numerous massacres. Above all, and here is a trap that Christianity has mostly avoided, by awarding its prophet a human body but a non-human nature, he was blessed with numerous descendants and thus placed his religious posterity in a position where it was hostage to his physical one. Nothing is more human and fallible than the dynastic or hereditary principle, and Islam has been racked from its birth by squabbles between princelings and pretenders all claiming the relevant drop of original blood. If the total of those claiming descent from the founder was added up, it would probably exceed the number of holy nails and splinters that went to make up the 1,000-foot cross on which, judging by the number of splinter-shaped relics, Jesus was evidently martyred. As with the lineage of the Isnads, a direct kinship line with the prophet can be established if one happens to know and be able to pay the right local imam. In the same way, Muslims still make a certain obeisance to those same satanic verses and tread the pagan polytheistic path that was laid out long before their prophet was born. Every year at the Hajj, or annual pilgrimage, one can see them circling the cuboid Kaaba shrine in the centre of Mecca, taking care to do so 7 times, following the direction of the sun around the earth, as Karen Armstrong weirdly and no doubt multiculturally puts it, before kissing the black stone set in the Kaaba's wall. This probable meteorite, which no doubt impressed the yokels when it first fell to earth, the gods must be crazy, no, make that God must be crazy, is a stop on the way to other ancient pre-Islamic propitiations, during which pebbles must be hurled defiantly at a rock that represents the evil one. Animal sacrifices complete the picture. Like many but not all of Islam's principal sites, Mecca is closed to unbelievers, which somewhat contradicts its claim to universality. It is often said that Islam differs from other monotheisms in not having had a reformation. This is both correct and incorrect. There are versions of Islam, most notably the Sufi, much detested by the devout, which are principally spiritual rather than literal and which have taken on some accretions from other faiths. And since Islam has avoided the mistake of having an absolute papacy, capable of uttering binding edicts, hence the proliferation of conflicting fatwas from conflicting authorities, its adherents cannot be told to cease believing what they once held as dogma. This might be to the good, but the fact remains that Islam's core claim, to be unimprovable and final, is at once absurd and unalterable. Its many warring and discrepant sects, from Ismaili to Ahmadi, all agree on this indissoluble claim. Reformation has meant, for Jews and Christians, a minimal willingness to reconsider Holy Writ as if it were, as Salman Rushdie so daringly proposed in his turn, something that can be subjected to literary and textual scrutiny. The number of possible Bibles is now admitted to be immense, and we know, for example, that the portentous Christian term Jehovah is a mistranslation of the unuttered spaces between the letters of the Hebrew Yahweh. Yet no comparable project has ever been undertaken in Quranic scholarship. No serious attempt has been made to catalogue the discrepancies between its various editions and manuscripts, and even the most tentative efforts to do so have been met with almost inquisitional rage. A critical case in point is the work of Christoph Luxemburg, the Syriac Aramaic version of the Quran, published in Berlin in the year 2000. Luxemburg coolly proposes that far from being a monoglot screed, the Quran is far better understood once it is conceded that many of its words are Syriac Aramaic rather than Arabic. His most celebrated example concerns the rewards of a martyr in paradise. When retranslated and redacted, the heavenly offering consists of sweet white raisins rather than virgins. This is the same language in the same region from which much of Judaism and Christianity emerged. There can be no doubt that unfettered research would result in the dispelling of much obscurantism. But at the very point when Islam ought to be joining its predecessors in subjecting itself to rereadings, there is a soft consensus among almost all the religious that because of the supposed duty of respect that we owe the faithful, this is the very time to allow Islam to assert its claims at their own face value. Once again, faith is helping to choke free inquiry and the emancipating consequences that it might bring. Chapter 10. The Tawdriness of the Miraculous and the Decline of Hell. The daughters of the high priest Aeneas changed whatever they chose into wheat, wine, or oil. Athalida, daughter of Mercury, was resuscitated several times. Aesculapius resuscitated Hippolytus. Hercules dragged Alcestis back from death. Heres returned to the world after passing a fortnight in hell. The parents of Romulus and Remus were a god and a Vestal Virgin. The Palladium fell from heaven in the city of Troy. The hair of Berenice became a constellation. Give me the name of one people among whom incredible prodigies were not performed, especially when few knew how to read and write. Voltaire, Miracles and Idolatry. An old fable concerns the comeuppance of a braggart who was forever retelling the story of a truly stupendous leap that he had once made on the island of Rhodes. Never, it seemed, had there ever been witnessed such a heroic long jump. Though the teller never grew tired of the tale, the same could not be said of his audience. Finally, as he again drew breath to relate the story of the great feat, one of those present silenced him by saying gruffly, "Hic Rhodus, hic Salta. Here is Rhodes. Jump here." In much the same way as prophets and seers and great theologians seem to have died out, so the age of miracles seems to lie somewhere in our past. If the religious were wise or had the confidence of their convictions, they ought to welcome the eclipse of this age of fraud and conjuring. But faith yet again discredits itself by proving to be insufficient to satisfy the faithful. Actual events are still required to impress the credulous. We have no difficulty in seeing this when we study the witch doctors and magicians and soothsayers of earlier or more remote cultures. Obviously it was a clever person who first learned to predict an eclipse and then to use this planetary event to impress and cow his audience. Ancient kings in Cambodia worked out the day on which the Mekong and the Bassac rivers would annually start to flood and conjoin, and under terrific water pressure, appear to actually reverse their flow back into the Great Lake at Tonle Sap. Relatively soon there was a ceremony at which the divinely appointed leader would duly appear and seem to order the waters to flow backward. Moses on the shore of the Red Sea could only have gaped at such a thing. In more modern times, the showman King Sihanouk of Cambodia exploited this same natural miracle to considerable effect. Given all that, it is surprising how petty some of the supernatural miracles now seem. As with spiritualist seances, which cynically offer burblings from the beyond to relatives of the late deceased, nothing truly interesting is ever said or done. To the story of Muhammad's night flight to Jerusalem, the hoofprint of his horse Burak is still allegedly to be seen on the site of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, it would be unkind to make the obvious riposte that horses cannot and do not fly. It is more pertinent to notice that people, ever since the beginning of their long and exhausting journeys across the earth's surface, gazing for days at the rear end of a mule, have fantasized about speeding up the tedious process. Folkloric seven-league boots can give the wearer a spring in his step, but this is only tinkering with the problem. The real dream for thousands of years involved envy of the birds, feathered descendants of the dinosaurs, as we now know, and the yearning to fly. Chariots in the sky, angels that could glide freely on the thermals. It's only too easy to see the root of the wish. Thus the prophet speaks to the longing of every peasant who wishes that his beast could take wing and get on with it. But, given infinite power, one might have thought that a more striking or less simple-minded miracle could have been confected. Levitation plays a vast role in Christian fantasy as well, as the stories of the Ascension and the Assumption confirm. At that epoch, the sky was thought to be a bowl and its ordinary weather a source of portent or intervention. Given this pathetically limited view of the cosmos, the most trivial event could appear miraculous, while an event that would truly astonish us, such as the sun ceasing to move, could yet appear as a local phenomenon. Assuming that a miracle is a favourable change in the natural order, the last word on the subject was written by the Scottish philosopher David Hume, who granted us free will in the matter. A miracle is a disturbance or interruption in the expected and established course of things. This could involve anything from the sun rising in the west to an animal suddenly bursting into the recitation of verse. Very well, then. Free will also involves decision. If you seem to witness such a thing, there are two possibilities. The first is that the laws of nature have been suspended in your favour. The second is that you are under a misapprehension or suffering from a delusion. Thus, the likelihood of the second must be weighed against the likelihood of the first. If you only hear a report of the miracle from a second or third party, the odds must be adjusted accordingly before you can decide to credit a witness who claims to have seen something that you did not see. And if you are separated from the sighting by many generations and have no independent corroboration, the odds must be adjusted still more drastically. Again, we might call upon the trusty Occam, who warned us not to multiply unnecessary contingencies. Thus, let me give one ancient and one modern example, the first being bodily resurrection and the second being UFOs. Miracles have declined in their wondrous impact since ancient times. Moreover, the more recent ones that have been offered us have been slightly tawdry. The notorious annual liquefaction of the blood of San Gennaro in Naples, for example, is a phenomenon that can easily be and has been repeated by any competent conjurer. Great secular magicians like Harry Houdini and James Randi have demonstrated with ease that levitation, firewalking, water divining and spoon bending can all be performed under laboratory conditions in order to expose the fraud and to safeguard the unwary customer from a fleecing. Miracles in any case do not vindicate the truth of the religion that practices them. Aaron supposedly vanquished Pharaoh's magicians in an open competition but did not deny that they could perform wonders as well. However, there has not been a claimed resurrection for some time, and no shaman who purports to do it has ever agreed to reproduce his trick in such a way as to stand a challenge. Thus, we must ask ourselves, has the art of resurrection died out, or are we relying on dubious sources? The New Testament is itself a highly dubious source. One of Professor Barton Ehrman's more astonishing findings is that the account of Jesus' resurrection in the Gospel of Mark was only added many years later. But according to the New Testament, the thing could be done in an almost commonplace way. Jesus managed it twice in other people's cases by raising both Lazarus and the daughter of Jairus, and nobody seems to have thought it worthwhile to interview either survivor to ask about their extraordinary experiences. Nor does anyone seem to have kept a record of whether or not or how these two individuals died again. If they stayed immortal, then they joined the ancient company of the wandering Jew, who was condemned by early Christianity to keep walking forever after he met Jesus on the Via Dolorosa, this misery being inflicted on a mere bystander in order to fulfil the otherwise unfulfilled prophecy that Jesus would come again in the lifetime of at least one person who'd seen him the first time around. On the same day that Jesus met that luckless vagrant, he was himself put to death with revolting cruelty, at which time, according to the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 27, verses 52 to 53, the graves were opened, and many bodies of the saints which slept arose and came out of the graves after his resurrection and went into the holy city and appeared unto many. This seems incoherent, since the corpses apparently rose both at the time of the death on the cross and of the resurrection, but it is narrated in the same matter-of-fact way as the earthquake, the rending of the veil of the temple, two other events that did not attract the attention of any historian, and the reverent comments of the Roman centurion. This supposed frequency of resurrection can only undermine the uniqueness of the one by which mankind purchased forgiveness of sins, and there is no cult or religion before or since, from Osiris to vampirism to voodoo, that does not rely on some innate belief in the undead. To this day, Christians disagree as to whether the Day of Judgment will give you back the old wreck of a body that has already died on you, or will re-equip you in some other form. For now, and on a review even of the claims made by the faithful, one can say that resurrection would not prove the truth of the dead man's doctrine, nor his paternity, nor the probability of still another return in fleshly or recognizable form. Yet again also, too much is being proved. The action of a man who volunteers to die for his fellow creatures is universally regarded as noble. The extra claim not to have really died makes the whole sacrifice tricky and meretricious. Thus, those who say Christ died for my sins when he did not really die at all are making a statement that is false in its own terms. Having no reliable or consistent witnesses in anything like the time period needed to certify such an extraordinary claim, we are finally entitled to say that we have a right, if not an obligation, to respect ourselves enough to disbelieve the whole thing. That is, unless or until superior evidence is presented, which it has not been, and exceptional claims demand exceptional evidence. I have spent much of my life as a correspondent and long ago became used to reading first-hand accounts of the very same events I had witnessed, written by people I otherwise trusted, which did not accord with my own. In my days as a Fleet Street correspondent, I even read stories in print under my own name which were not recognisable to me, once the sub-editors had finished with them. And I have interviewed some of the hundreds of thousands of people who claim to have had direct encounters with spacecraft, or the crew of spacecraft from another galaxy. Some of these are so vivid and detailed, and so comparable with other depositions from other people who cannot have compared notes, that a few impressionable academics have proposed that we grant them the presumption of truth. But here is the obvious alchemist reason why it would be utterly wrong to do so. If the huge number of contacts and abductees are telling even a particle of truth, then it follows that their alien friends are not attempting to keep their own existence a secret. Well, in that case, why do they never stay still for anything more than a single-shot photo? There has never been an uncut roll of film offered, let alone a small piece of a metal unavailable on Earth, or a tiny sample of alien tissue. And sketches of the beings have a consistent anthropomorphic resemblance to those offered in science fiction comics. Since travel from Alpha Centauri, the preferred origin, would involve some bending of the laws of physics, even the smallest particle of matter would be of enormous use and would have a literally earth-shattering effect, instead of which, nothing. Nothing, that is, except the growth of a huge new superstition, based on a belief in occult texts and shards that are available only to a favoured few. Well, I've seen that happen before. The only responsible decision is to suspend or withhold judgment until the votaries have come up with something that is not merely childish. Extend this to the present day, where the statues of virgins or saints are sometimes said to weep or bleed. Even if I could not easily introduce you to people who can produce this identical effect in their spare time, using pig fat or other materials, I would still ask myself why a deity should be content to produce such a paltry effect. As it happens, I am one of the very few people who has ever taken part in the examination of a sainthood cause, as the Roman Catholic Church calls it. In June of 2001, I was invited by the Vatican to testify at a hearing on the beatification of Agnes Bujashu, an ambitious Albanian nun who had become well known under the nom de guerre of Mother Teresa. Although the then Pope had abolished the famous office of devil's advocate, the better to confirm and canonize an enormous number of new saints, The church was still obliged to seek testimony from critics, and thus I found myself representing the devil, as it were, pro bono. I had already helped expose one of the miracles connected with the work of this woman. The man who originally made her famous was a distinguished, if rather silly, British evangelist, later a Catholic, named Malcolm Muggeridge. It was his BBC documentary, Something Beautiful for God, which launched the Mother Teresa brand on the world in 1969. The cameraman for this film was a man named Ken McMillan, who had won high praise for his work on Lord Clark's great art history series, Civilization. His understanding of colour and lighting was of a high order. Here is the story, as Muggeridge told it, in the book that accompanied the film. Mother Teresa's home for the dying is dimly lit by small windows high up in the walls, and Ken McMillan was adamant that filming was quite impossible there. We only had one small light with us, and to get the place adequately lighted in the time at our disposal was quite impossible. It was decided that nonetheless Ken should have a go, but by way of insurance he took as well some film in an outside courtyard where some of the inmates were sitting in the sun. In the processed film, the part taken inside was bathed in a particularly beautiful soft light, whereas the part taken outside was rather dim and confused. I myself am absolutely convinced that the technically unaccountable light is in fact the kindly light that Cardinal Newman refers to in his well-known exquisite hymn. Muggeridge concluded that this is precisely what miracles are for, to reveal the inner reality of God's outward creation. I'm personally persuaded that Ken recorded the first authentic photographic miracle. I fear I talked and wrote about it to the point of tedium. He was certainly correct in that last sentence. By the time he had finished, he'd made Mother Teresa into a world-famous figure. My contribution was to check out and put into print the direct verbal testimony of Ken McMillan, the cameraman himself. Here it is. During Something Beautiful for God, there was an episode where we were taken to a building that Mother Teresa called the House of the Dying. Peter Chafer, the director, said, "Ah, well, it's very dark in here. Do you think we can get something?" And we'd just taken delivery at the BBC of some new film made by Kodak, which we hadn't had time to test before we left. So I said to Peter, "Well, we may as well have a go." So we shot it. And when we got back several weeks later, a month or two later, we're sitting in the Rush's Theatre at Ealing Studios, and eventually up come the shots of the House of the Dying. And it was surprising. You could see every detail. And I said, "That's amazing, that's extraordinary." And I was going to go on to say, you know, three cheers for Kodak. I didn't get a chance to say that, though, because Malcolm, sitting in the front row, spun around and said, "It's divine light. It's Mother Teresa. You'll find it's divine light, old boy." And 3 or 4 days later, I found that I was being phoned by journalists from London newspapers who were saying things like, "We hear you've just come back from India with Malcolm Muggeridge, and you were the witness of a miracle." So a star was born. For these and for my other criticisms, I was invited by the Vatican into a closed room containing a Bible, a tape recorder, a Monsignor, a deacon, and a priest, and asked if I could throw any light of my own on the matter of the servant of God, Mother Teresa. But even as they appeared to be asking me this in good faith, their colleagues on the other side of the world were certifying the necessary miracle that would allow the beatification, prelude to full canonization, to go forward. Mother Teresa died in 1997. On the first anniversary of her death, two nuns in the Bengali village of Raigunch claimed to have strapped an aluminum medal of the departed, a medal that had supposedly been in contact with her dead body, to the abdomen of a woman named Monica Besra. This woman, who was said to be suffering from a large uterine tumour, was thereupon quite cured of it. It will be noticed that Monica is a Catholic girl's name not very common in Bengal, and thus that probably the patient and certainly the nuns were already Mother Teresa fans. This definition would not cover Dr. Manju Murshed, the superintendent of the local hospital, nor Dr. T.K. Biswas and his gynecologist colleague, Dr. Ranjan Mustafi. All three came forward to say that Mrs. Besra had been suffering from tuberculosis and an ovarian growth and had been successfully treated for both afflictions. Dr. Murshed was particularly annoyed at the numerous calls he had received from Mother Teresa's order, the missionaries of charity, pressing him to say that the cure had been miraculous. The patient herself did not make a very impressive interview subject, talking at high speed because, as she put it, she might otherwise forget, and begging to be excused questions because she might have to remember. Her own husband, a man named Selku Murmu, broke silence after a while to say that his wife had been cured by ordinary, regular medical treatment. Any hospital supervisor in any country will tell you that patients sometimes make astonishing recoveries, just as apparently healthy people often fall inexplicably and gravely ill. Those who desire to certify miracles may wish to say that such recoveries have no natural explanation. But this does not at all mean that there is therefore a supernatural one. In this case, however, there was nothing even remotely surprising in Mrs. Besra's return to health. Some familiar disorders had been treated with well-known methods. Extraordinary claims were being made without even ordinary evidence. Yet there will soon come a day in Rome when a vast and solemn ceremony will proclaim the sainthood of Mother Teresa as one whose intercession can improve upon medicine to the entire world. Not only is this a scandal in itself, but it will further postpone the day when Indian villagers cease to trust quacks and fakirs. In other words, many people will die needlessly as a result of this phony and contemptible miracle. If this is the best the Church can do, in a time when its claims can be checked by physicians and reporters, it isn't difficult to imagine what was rigged in past times of ignorance and fear when the priests faced less doubt or opposition. Once again, the razor of Occam is clean and decisive. When two explanations are offered, one must discard the one that explains the least or explains nothing at all, or raises more questions than it answers. The same goes for those occasions when the laws of nature are apparently suspended in a way that does not offer joy or apparent consolation. Natural disasters are actually not violations of the laws of nature, but rather are part of the inevitable fluctuations within them. But they have always been used to overawe the gullible with the mightiness of God's disapproval. Early Christians operating in zones of Asia Minor where earthquakes were and are frequent would rally crowds when a pagan temple fell down and urge them to convert while there was still time. The colossal volcanic explosion at Krakatoa in the late 19th century provoked an enormous swing toward Islam among the terrified population of Indonesia. All the holy books talk excitedly of floods, hurricanes, lightning, and other portents. After the terrible Asian tsunami of 2005 and after the inundation of New Orleans in 2006, quite learned and serious men, such as the Archbishop of Canterbury, were reduced to the level of stupefied peasants when they publicly agonized over how to interpret God's will in the matter. But if one makes the simple assumption, based on absolutely certain knowledge, that we live on a planet that is still cooling, has a molten core, faults and cracks in its crust, and a turbulent weather system, then there is simply no need for any such anxiety. Everything is already explained. I fail to see why the religious are so reluctant to admit this. It would free them from all the futile questions about why God permits so much suffering. But apparently this annoyance is a small price to pay in order to keep alive the myth of divine intervention. The suspicion that a calamity might also be a punishment is further useful in that it allows an infinity of speculation. After New Orleans, which suffered from a lethal combination of being built below sea level and neglected by the Bush administration, I learned from a senior rabbi in Israel that it was revenge for the evacuation of Jewish settlers from the Gaza Strip, and from the mayor of New Orleans, who had not performed his own job with exceptional prowess, that it was God's verdict on the invasion of Iraq. You can nominate your own favourite sin here, as did the Reverends Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell after the immolation of the World Trade Center. In that instance, the proximate cause was to be sought and found in America's surrender to homosexuality and abortion. Some ancient Egyptians believed that sodomy was the cause of earthquakes. I expect this interpretation to revive with especial force when the San Andreas Fault next gives a shudder under the Gomorrah of San Francisco. When the debris had eventually settled on Ground Zero, it was found that two pieces of mangled girder still stood in the shape of a cross, and much wondering comment resulted. Since all architecture has always involved crossbeams, it would be surprising only if such a feature did not emerge. I admit that I would have been impressed if the wreckage had formed itself into a Star of David or a Star and Crescent, but there is no record of this ever having occurred anywhere, even in places where local people might be impressed by it. And remember, miracles are supposed to occur at the behest of a being who is omnipotent, as well as omniscient and omnipresent. One might hope for more magnificent performances than ever seem to occur. The evidence for faith, then, seems to leave faith looking even weaker than it would if it stood alone and unsupported, all by itself. What can be asserted without evidence can also be dismissed without evidence. This is even more true when the evidence eventually offered is so shoddy and self-interested. The argument from authority is the weakest of all arguments. It is weak when it is asserted at second or third hand, the good book says. And it is even weaker when asserted at first hand, as every child knows, who has heard a parent say, because I say so, and as every parent knows, who who's heard himself reduced to uttering words he once found so unconvincing. Nonetheless, it takes a certain leap of another kind to find oneself asserting that all religion is made up by ordinary mammals and has no secret or mystery to it. Behind the veil of Oz, there's nothing but bluff. Can this really be true? As one who's always been impressed by the weight of history and culture, I do keep asking myself this question. Was it all in vain, then, the great struggle of the theologians and scholars, and the stupendous efforts of painters and architects and musicians, to create something lasting and marvellous that would testify to the glory of God? Not at all. It does not matter to me whether Homer was one person or many, or whether Shakespeare was a secret Catholic or a closet agnostic. I should not feel my own world destroyed if the greatest writer about love and tragedy and comedy and morals was finally revealed to have been the Earl of Oxford all along, though I must add that sole authorship is important to me, and I would be saddened and diminished to learn that Bacon had been the man. Shakespeare has much more moral salience than the Talmud or the Quran, or any account of the fearful squabbles of Iron Age tribes. But there's a great deal to be learned and appreciated from the scrutiny of religion, and one often finds oneself standing atop the shoulders of distinguished writers and thinkers who were certainly one's intellectual and sometimes even one's moral superiors. Many of them in their own time had ripped away the disguise of idolatry and paganism, and even risked martyrdom for the sake of disputes with their own co-religionists. However, a moment in history has now arrived when even a pygmy such as myself can claim to know more, through no merit of his own, and to see that the final ripping of the whole disguise is overdue. Between them, the sciences of textual criticism, archaeology, physics, and molecular biology have shown religious myths to be false and man-made, and have also succeeded in evolving better and more enlightened explanations. The loss of faith can be compensated by the newer and finer wonders that we have before us, as well as by immersion in the near-miraculous work of Homer and Shakespeare and Milton and Tolstoy and Proust, all of which was also man-made, though one sometimes wonders, as in the case of Mozart. I can say this as one whose own secular faith has been shaken and discarded, not without pain. When I was a Marxist, I did not hold my opinions as a matter of faith, but I did have the conviction that a sort of unified field theory might have been discovered. The concept of historical and dialectical materialism was not an absolute, and it did not have any supernatural element, but it did have its messianic element in the idea that an ultimate moment might arrive, and it most certainly had its martyrs and saints and doctrinaires, and, after a while, its mutually excommunicating rival papacies. It also had its schisms and inquisitions and heresy hunts. I was a member of a dissident sect that admired Rosa Luxemburg and Leon Trotsky, and I can say definitely that we also had our prophets. Rosa Luxemburg seemed almost like a combination of Cassandra and Jeremiah when she thundered about the consequences of the First World War. And the great three-volume biography of Leon Trotsky by Isaac Deutscher was actually entitled The Prophet, in his three stages of being armed, unarmed, and outcast. As a young man, Deutscher had been trained for the rabbinate and would have made a brilliant Talmudist, as would Trotsky. Here is what Trotsky says, anticipating the Gnostic Gospel of Judas, about the way that Stalin took over the Bolshevik Party. Of Christ's 12 apostles, Judas alone proved to be traitor. But if he had acquired power, he would have represented the other 11 apostles as traitors, and also all the lesser apostles, whom Luke numbers as 70. And here in Deutsch's chilling words is what happened when the pro-Nazi forces in Norway forced the government to deny Trotsky asylum and deport him once again, to wander the world until he met death. The old man met with the Norwegian foreign minister, Trygve Lie, and others, and then Trotsky raised his voice so that it resounded through the halls and corridors of the ministry. This is your first act of surrender to Nazism in your own country. You will pay for this. You think yourselves free and secure to deal with the political exile as you please, but the day is near, remember this, the day is near when the Nazis will drive you from your country, all of you. Trygve Lie shrugged at this odd piece of soothsaying. Yet, after less than 4 years, the same government had indeed to flee from Norway before the Nazi invasion. And as the ministers and their aged King Hakon stood on the coast, huddled together and waiting anxiously for a boat that was to take them to England, they recalled with awe Trotsky's words, as a prophet's curse come true. Trotsky had a sound materialist critique that enabled him to be prescient, not all of the time by any means, but impressively so on some occasions, and he certainly had a sense, expressed in his emotional essay, Literature and Revolution, of the unquenchable yearning of the poor and oppressed to rise above the strictly material world and to achieve something transcendent. For a good part of my life, I had a share in this idea that I have not yet quite abandoned. But there came a time when I could not protect myself and indeed did not wish to protect myself from the onslaught of reality. Marxism, I conceded, had its intellectual and philosophical and ethical glories, but they were in the past. Something of the heroic period might perhaps be retained, but the fact had to be faced. There was no longer any guide to the future. In addition, the very concept of a total solution had led to the most appalling human sacrifices and to the invention of excuses for them. Those of us who had sought a rational alternative to religion had reached a terminus that was comparably dogmatic. What else was to be expected of something that was produced by the close cousins of chimpanzees? Infallibility? Thus, dear reader, if you've come this far and found your own faith undermined, as I hope, I am willing to say that to some extent I know what you're going through. There are days when I miss my old convictions as if they were an amputated limb. But in general I feel better, and no less radical, and you will feel better too, I guarantee, once you leave hold of the doctrinaire and allow your chainless mind to do its own thinking. Chapter 11. The Lowly Stamp of Their Origin. Religion's Corrupt Beginnings. Where questions of religion are concerned, people are guilty of every possible sort of dishonesty and intellectual misdemeanor. Sigmund Freud, The Future of an Illusion. The various forms of worship which prevailed in the Roman world were all considered by the people to be equally true, by the philosopher as equally false, and by the magistrate as equally useful. Edward Gibbon, Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. An old popular saying from Chicago has it that if you want to maintain your respect for city aldermen or your appetite for sausages, you should take care not to be present when the former are being groomed or the latter are being manufactured. It is the anatomy of man, said Engels, that is the key to the anatomy of the ape. Thus, if we watch the process of a religion in its formation, we can make some assumptions about the origins of those religions that were put together before most people could read. From a wide selection of openly manufactured sausage religions, I shall pick the Melanesian cargo cult, the Pentecostal superstar Marjo, and the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, commonly known as the Mormons. The thought has surely occurred to many people throughout the ages, what if there is an afterlife but no God? What if there is a God but no afterlife? As far as I know, the clearest writer to give expression to this problem was Thomas Hobbes, in his 1651 masterwork, Leviathan. I strongly recommend that you read Part 3, Chapter 38, and Part 4, Chapter 44, for yourselves, because Hobbes's command of both Holy Scripture and the English language is quite breathtaking. He also reminds us how perilous it was, and always has been, even to think about these things. His brisk and ironic throat-clearing is eloquent in itself. Reflecting on the nonsense story of Adam's fall, the original instance of someone being created free and then loaded with impossible-to-obey prohibitions, Hobbes opined, not forgetting fearfully to add that he did so with submission nevertheless, both in this and in all questions, whereof the determination dependeth on the Scriptures, that if Adam was condemned to death by sinning, his death must have been postponed, since he contrived to raise a large posterity before actually dying. Having planted the subversive thought that forbidding Adam to eat from one tree lest he die, and from another lest he live forever, is absurd and contradictory, Hobbes was forced to imagine alternative scriptures and even alternative punishments and alternative eternities. His point was that people might not obey the rule of men if they were more afraid of divine retribution than of horrible death in the here and now. But he had acknowledged the process whereby people are always free to make up a religion that suits or gratifies or flatters them. Samuel Butler was to adapt this idea in his Erewhon Revisited. In the original Erewhon, Mr. Higgs pays a visit to a remote country from which he eventually makes his escape in a balloon. Returning 2 decades later, he finds that in his absence he has become a god named the Sun Child, worshipped on the day he ascended into heaven. 2 high priests are on hand to celebrate the ascension, and when Higgs threatens to expose them and reveal himself as a mere mortal, he's told, "You must not do that, because all the morals of this country abound around this myth, and if they once know that you did not ascend into heaven, they will all become wicked." In 1964, there appeared a celebrated documentary movie called Mondo Carne, or The World of the Dog, in which the directors captured numerous human cruelties and illusions. This was the first occasion on which one could see a new religion being assembled, in plain view, on camera. The inhabitants of the Pacific Islands may have been separated for centuries from the more economically developed world, but when visited by the fatal impact, many of them were shrewd enough to get the point immediately. Here were great vessels with billowing sails, bearing treasures and weapons and devices that were beyond any compare. Some of the more untutored islanders did what many people do when confronted with a new phenomenon, and tried to translate it into a discourse that they could themselves understand. Not unlike those fearful Aztecs who, first seeing mounted Spanish soldiers in Mesoamerica, concluded that they had a centaur for an enemy. These poor souls decided that the Westerners were their long-mourned ancestors, come back at last with goods from beyond the grave. That illusion cannot long have survived the encounter with the colonists, but later it was observed in several places that the brighter islanders had a better idea. Docks and jetties were built, they noticed, after which more ships came and unloaded more goods. Acting by analogy and mimesis, the locals constructed their own jetties and waited for these, too, to attract some ships. Futile as this proceeding was, it badly retarded the advance of later Christian missionaries. When they made their appearance, they were asked where the gifts were, and soon came up with some trinkets. In the 20th century, the cargo cult revived in an even more impressive and touching form. Units of the United States Armed Forces, arriving in the Pacific to build airfields for the war on Japan, found that they were the objects of slavish emulation. Local enthusiasts abandoned their lightly worn Christian observances and devoted all their energies to the construction of landing strips that might attract loaded airplanes. They made simulated antennae out of bamboo. They built and lit fires to simulate the flares that guided the American planes to land. This still goes on, which is the saddest bit of the Mondo Carne sequence. On the island of Tana, an American GI was declared to be the Redeemer. His name, John Frum, seems to have been an invention too. But even after the last serviceman flew or sailed away after 1945, the eventual return of the Savior Frum was preached and predicted, and an annual ceremony still bears his name. On another island named New Britain, adjacent to Papua New Guinea, the cult is even more strikingly analogous. It has 10 commandments, the 10 laws, a trinity that has one presence in heaven and another on earth, and a ritual system of paying tributes in the hope of propitiating these authorities. If the ritual is performed with sufficient purity and fervor, so its adherents believe, then an age of milk and honey will be ushered in. This radiant future, sad to say, is known as the period of the companies and will cause New Britain to flourish and prosper as if it were a multinational corporation. Some people may be insulted at even the suggestion of a comparison here, but are not the holy books of official monotheism absolutely dripping with material yearning and with admiring, almost mouth-watering descriptions of Solomon's wealth, the thriving flocks and herds of the faithful, the rewards for a good Muslim in paradise, to say nothing of many, many lurid tales of plunder and spoils? Jesus, it is true, shows no personal interest in gain, but he does speak of treasure in heaven and even of mansions as an inducement to follow him. Is it not further true that all religions down the ages have shown a keen interest in the amassment of material goods in the real world? The thirst for money and worldly comfort is only a subtext of the mind-numbing story of Marjo Gortner, the infant phenomenon of American evangelical hucksterism. Grotesquely christened Marjo, a cretinous lumping together of the names Mary and Joseph, by his parents, young Master Gortner was thrust into the pulpit at the age of 4, dressed in a revolting little Lord Fauntleroy suit, and told to say that he'd been divinely commanded to preach. If he complained or cried, his mother would hold him under the water tap or press a cushion on his face, always being careful, as he relates it, to leave no marks. Trained like a seal, he soon attracted the cameras, and by the age of 6 was officiating at the weddings of grown-ups. His celebrity spread, and many flocked to see the miraculous child. His best guess is that he raised $3 million in contributions, none of which was earmarked for his education or his own future. At the age of 17, he rebelled against his pitiless and cynical parents and dropped out into the early 60s California counterculture. In the immortal Christmas children's pantomime Peter Pan, there comes a climactic moment when the little angel Tinkerbell seems to be dying. The glowing light that represents her on the stage begins to dim, and there is only one possible way to save the dire situation. An actor steps up to the front of the house and asks all the children, "Do you believe in fairies?" If they keep confidently answering yes, then the tiny light will start to brighten again. Who can object to this? One wants not to spoil children's belief in magic. There will be plenty of time later for disillusionment. And nobody is waiting at the exit, asking them hoarsely to contribute their piggy banks to the Tinkerbell Salvation Church. The events at which Marjo was exploited had all the intellectual content of the Tinkerbell scene, nastily combined with the ethics of Captain Hook. A decade or so later, Mr. Gortner exacted the best possible revenge.